You are listening to The Adventures of Saraputa and Mogalana. I'm your host, Morris Sullivan. If you've been listening for a while, you know I'm talking about the things that I think are most useful to know if you're practicing Buddhism. And along those lines, I want to tell you about roles that Saraputta and Mogalana played in creating the Pali Canon, the oldest of the surviving collections of Buddhist scriptures. The Pali Canon consists of three sets of writings, which is referred to as the Tipitaka. Tipitaka is a compound Pali word that means three baskets. The first of the baskets is the Sutta Pitaka, the collection of discourses given by the Buddha and key followers during and shortly after his life. Next is the Vinaya Pitaka, the discipline basket, which is the guidelines for monastic behavior, running a monastery, things like that. Finally, there's the Abhidhamma Pitaka, which is the basket of special or further doctrines. This is the collection of commentaries and elaborations on the Buddha's teaching. These are all considered in one way or another to be the word of the Buddha. So there are what you might consider mythic explanations for how some of these things came into existence. For instance, the Buddha's mother, who had passed away not long after his birth, had been reborn a Deva in one of the blissful realms. The Buddha went to visit the Deva realms and he met his mother there. And he spent a vasa there, the three-month rainy season, teaching the Abhidhamma to the Devas and the Brahmas, the two orders of heavenly beings. As a result, his mother and numerous other Devas and Brahmas gained stream entry, meaning they would eventually realize enlightenment. After spending each day teaching the Abhidhamma to the Devas and Brahmas, the Buddha would appear in a vision to Saraputta and transmit the teachings to him, too. Saraputta would then spend the next day passing along the Abhidhamma to 500 monks who were staying with him at a monastery. Toward the end of the rains, Mogalana went to visit the Buddha in heaven. The Buddha told him that he would return to the human world, to the place where Saraputta was staying, on the full moon following the rains. As promised, the Buddha appeared that night at the city gate with six colored rays of light shining from his body and accompanied by a large following of Devas and Brahmas. Saraputta, the 500 monks, and a crowd of lay supporters all came out to greet him. Saraputta was in awe at the sight of the Buddha, resplendent with colored light, surrounded by these heavenly beings. As he bowed to him, he remarked on how amazed he was to see the Buddha so adored by both humans and deities. The Buddha replied that wise beings who practice meditation and develop insight delight in the freedom that comes from that, and likewise the arahants and Buddhas who fully comprehend the Dharma are held dear by the gods. Hearing this, Saraputta's 500 monks became arahants, and the lay congregation attained stream entry. And I was actually asked this question earlier this week in an email. It comes up a lot. So the first talk that I mentioned the seals of the Dharma. So the first three of these are known as the marks of existence. You know, I don't remember all this. But I talked at some length about the first seal and the first mark of existence, which is the truth of suffering and the end of suffering. And this is important because I'll keep reminding you about this one. When the Buddha was asked about various mystical things, where does the universe come from and that kind of stuff, he'd say, I don't teach that. I teach suffering and the end of suffering. In other words, how is suffering created? How do we stop creating it? And so those are the teachings that really we want to understand. So suffering comes in a couple of kinds. And one is our own. And then there's suffering in our world. Last week, or a couple of weeks ago, Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh passed away. And I mentioned that weekend that he established engaged Buddhism, which is really addressing Buddhism in the world, or using Buddhism to address the suffering in the world, which comes from developing goodwill and living compassionately on our level. So our own suffering happens on a couple of different levels. First is pain, you know, the suffering of pain. You're born and you die and there's illness and there's death, and all of those things are painful. And then the other is fabrication, the stress that the mind fabricates. Like when you're meditating and your mind creates restlessness, or you get angry and say things that you later regret, or you create a lot of anxiety. Those are things that the mind does. And then there's suffering from change. There's stress that happens because of inconstancy. You get a new car and it's wonderful, and then it gets scratched, or you just get bored with it, or it wears out, or whatever. Or you get a new job and that's great. That's what you've been working for, and then it becomes less interesting over time. That's all the stress that arises as a result of change. And then the second seal really is that. It's everything that's made up of other things, which includes us, is impermanent. And everything that's impermanent is unstable, and so it's going to change eventually. And if we expect things to stay the same, we're going to be disappointed. And then also there's suffering in this life, and then the way we live in this life affects whatever happens after this lifetime. So those are the kind of the three marks of existence. The fourth mark of existence is misunderstanding the nature of existence creates suffering. Understanding the nature of existence leads to freedom. So I have a colleague, he's a Japanese fellow named Kenneth Tanaka, Dr. Kenneth Tanaka, and he's a Jodo Shinshu minister and a Buddhist studies teacher in Japan. And when he speaks to American students, he has this nice little device. He says, life is big, B-I-I-G. So the B stands for bumpy. Life is bumpy. If you're born, you're going to encounter some rough spots. And that's the first seal. And it's the first of the Four Noble Truths. The first of the Four Noble Truths is that there's difficulty. The first I, is interdependent. This starts with the not-self characteristic, which I'm going to go into in a little bit. There is no self as such. And so what I see is me is part of everything else, and so it's interdependent with everything else. The other I is impermanent, and I just talked about this, the stress that happens because of change. And the G in big is good. Life is ultimately good. We have the opportunity to awaken because we all have that capacity and thus transcend stress and suffering. And if we learn to use our attention carefully, we experience the goodness of life. And so we're able to transcend the difficulties that come from bumpiness, impermanence, and interdependence. So I want to go back to this I, the interdependent. So this is actually more of a Mahayana concept. And as I talked before, and you can listen to the other podcasts, there's different stages in Buddhist development over the past 2,500 years. And so this kind of comes along a little bit later, but it's grounded in one of those foundational teachings, which is the teaching on the not-self characteristic. And the fancy Buddhist word is anatta. There's a discourse there where the Buddha tells a number of monks, form is not self. He says, monks, form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to affliction, and one could have it of form. Let my form be thus, and let my form be not thus. And it would be that way. And since form is not self, it leads to affliction, and you can't do that. So in other words, this thing here, it's not mine. Not in any real sense of the word. Where form self, the Buddha said, then this form would not lead to affliction. He says, if this was mine, why would I let it cause suffering? He says, if it were me, if it were mine in some meaningful way, then I could say, let my form be this way, or let my form be that way, and that would happen. So I'm 5'11", give or take a half inch. But maybe I'd like to be an even 6 feet. Well, if it were up to me, I could do that. but I have limited control over my form. My form is made up of other things that are not me, not mine, so it's constantly changing. Like everything else, it's subject to change and eventually stressful. So what we see as a self and what we tend to attach to and we think has some permanence and enduring really is more of a process. And we call this process, fancy Buddhist word, is nama rupa, name and form. There are things that can be seen, measured, weighed, etc. That's the form. And then there are things that can only be known by name. They're just what we call them. And so he says, the nama part is also not self. Feeling is not self. Perception is not self. Mental formations are not self. Consciousness is not self. So if my feelings were really mine, if it was up to me, then I could say, let my feelings be this way and not that way. I can't decide how tall I can be. I can try to live healthier, maybe live longer. But when I come into existence and when I go away, really isn't up to me. I can do everything right and still get sick. I know this because I had COVID several weeks ago. I did all the right stuff and I still got sick. If it was up to me, that wouldn't have happened, right? So form is a good place for us to start with understanding this not self characteristic, because if we look closely, we see that what we think of as our boundaries are actually very illusory. Existence flows through us, through our breath, through the food we eat, the pores of our skin, all of those things. So it's maybe less obvious, but the words that we say, the mental formations, the things that we think and all of that, ripple through the world around us and are affected by everything around us. And so feelings, perceptions, cognitions, and consciousness are also not ours, and they're affected by and affect everything else. So I can't decide what I'm going to feel. If I could, I would feel good all the time. But part of the reason we meditate is to work very directly with this. I can sit down and to meditate and go, I'm not going to feel that pain in my back today. And what's going to happen? I'm going to feel that pain in my back, right? Because I don't have control over what arises. I can't decide what I'm going to see or taste or smell. I'd really like to only smell pleasant things. I'd like to smell roses and orange blossoms and coffee brewing. And I get that, but I also get manure and, you know, dog poop and all those kinds of things too, right? It's not mine. I can't decide what thoughts will arise. Unwanted thoughts come up. Again, in meditation, you sit down and go, okay, he says we're going to sit for 20 minutes. I'm not going to think for 20 minutes. Good luck. I can't decide what I'm going to be aware of or unaware of. I can't see the future. I can't stay awake all the time. My consciousness changes. Well, what's the point of all of this? What's the point of knowing all of this? The Buddha talks about each of these five aggregates and points out that each is impermanent and insubstantial. And yet, we identify with them. We think of them as us. Anybody made a mistake lately? How'd you feel about it? How did you feel about yourself when you made the mistake? I'm a university chaplain, and I get students coming in all the time. Oh, I failed a test. Oh, I'm so bad. No, you're not. You just failed a test. Don't identify with that. It's not you. So we'll make a mistake and we'll identify with it. I did this bad thing, so I'm bad. I failed, so I'm a failure. Things like that. The feelings that arise because of this misunderstanding can linger for some time. They can create suffering for us for a long time. We also tend to think that we need to feel a certain way, and we let our feelings define us. But what if instead we just recognize that feelings that arise, that we don't have control over them? And we don't have to let them control us then. One of the examples I like to use for this is I used to have a lot of anxiety about speaking in public. I was terrified of it. I had that public speaking anxiety real big time. And then I decided I had stuff worth saying, so I had to get used to that. So I worked with it. Now, most of the time, I really kind of enjoy it. But a few years ago, I was contacted by the Volusia County Commission, the person who schedules things for their meetings and stuff. And she said, you know, we're trying to make our meetings more inclusive. We want to have people from other faiths come in and give the opening, the invocation at the beginning of the commission meetings. And would you please do that? And I said, well, I'd be glad to. I'd love that. And so I prepared about a 2-minute prayer, had it all drafted out, because, you know, when you're speaking at a commission meeting, you've got to fit within a set time. So I didn't want to get up there and ramble or anything. I knew what I was going to say. I got there. I was looking forward to it. And then the county chair stood up and started the meeting. And oh my gosh, I felt this wave of anxiety. My heart was racing and my mouth got dry and I stood up and my knees were shaking. And I thought, I have anxiety. Now there was a time when I would have identified with that. I shouldn't be anxious. I have to be perfect. You know, they're gonna see me shaking my paper and they're gonna think I'm stupid. Things like that. These are the stories we tell ourselves. And actually, I know a little bit better. And I said, I feel anxious. That's interesting. Let me go give a prayer. So I only got anxious. I didn't have to get anxious about getting anxious. I didn't beat up on myself for 20 minutes afterward or anything like that. And it passed very quickly. And the only person who knew I was anxious was me. So when we don't identify with those feelings, when we just accept them and coexist with them, they have a lot less influence over what we do. So if we accept our feelings as not us, we can simply see them as phenomena that arise naturally, just like the combustion in our cells and the molecules that come and go as we breathe and things like that. We can view them as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. But we don't have to judge them as good or bad or awful or anything like that. We don't need to change them. They're not ours, so we can just live with them. We don't need to control what thoughts arise. But if we're not trying to own them, we can let them go when they're not going to be helpful. And we can develop them and cultivate them if they're going to lead us to happiness. We don't own form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. But what do we own? We own our actions and we own their results. So you may not be able to prevent an angry memory arising while you're meditating, but you can decide whether you're going to follow the storyline and add to it and think about what you should have said or what you should have done, all that kind of stuff. You can decide, when I recognize that, I'm going to let it go. You can't decide that you're not going to feel an itch in your shoulder while you're meditating, but you can decide whether you're going to react to it or whether you're going to just let it be there. So whatever comes up while you're meditating, you can let it go or let it be. And the same thing in the rest of life. When it comes up, you can let it go or let it be, or if there's something constructive to do with it, take a constructive action. The law of karma says if you do a good thing, you get a good result. You own the results of your actions. So that's the good news. We have the capacity to be freer from stress, freer from affliction, and happier, and to create a better life, a better world now and into the future. So back to the big, that's the good. We have this capacity. So how does this happen? And as you know, somebody said something about enlightenment earlier. You know, how do you get enlightened? And what does that mean? You know, in classical Buddhism, that meant transcending the cycle of coming and going, the cycle of birth and rebirth. And the same mechanisms that the Buddha talked about there also bring us back to suffering or bring us forward to someplace better. So there's this complicated thing called the 12 links of dependent origination that I'm going to go through, and you don't have to memorize this, but I want you to kind of understand how this works, because this is helpful. So the first link of origination is that ignorance, which is, or misunderstanding, not understanding what leads to suffering and what leads to happiness, leads to mental patterns. The fancy Buddhist word is sankharas. You don't have to remember that. Just know that misunderstanding leads to mental habits and mental formations that the next link, condition our awareness. So there are mental patterns that lead to impulses and actions, and some of them are conditioned by misunderstanding. And those condition our consciousness. So when we come into existence, our awareness has some of these mental formations attached to it. It comes equipped with these things. And some of them were conditioned by negative actions, negative karmas from the past. And the effects of negative karma tend to cling. So I'm gonna bring this to like the real world in a minute, but just kind of stay with me. Our consciousness, our name and form, our nama rupa, our form and all of the feelings and perceptions and all of that, come conditioned with consciousness. We're aware of it. And our name and form includes six senses. So most of, in the West, we think of five senses. In Buddhism, we have a sixth. You have a memory, you're aware of that. That's the sixth sense. Six senses condition perception. So we have to have six senses before we can perceive something. We become aware of our circumstances and events through contact between our mind and externals, and that's through the six senses. Perception leads to feelings. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Feelings lead to craving. You have a pleasant feeling, you want it to continue. You have an unpleasant feeling, you crave for it to end. Different forms of craving. Craving leads to clinging. You feel a need or a must. I like that. I need it. I want to keep it. Whatever. That's clinging. Clinging leads to becoming. So in this sort of micro sense, that means if you were meditating and you have an unpleasant feeling and you start to feel like, man, I really can't stand this unpleasant feeling, now you've become fidgety. Does that make sense? And if you go along with becoming, becoming leads to birth. So in the grand sense, in the sense of how does this lead to rebirth, this leads to become another existence. In the micro sense, this leads to continuing to be a fidgety person. Or if we were talking about the craving that arises because you tried to quit smoking and you're getting cravings or whatever, it leads to you continuing to be a smoker, that kind of thing. Leads to you continuing to have negative effects from this. And birth leads to stress. Birth leads to suffering. So if you're reborn a nicotine addict, well, you might get lung cancer or you get a cough or whatever. So this morning on the way here, I was driving down State Road 44. I live in DeLand, so I come in that way and then down 95. And so I happen to glance over as I'm driving down the road, and I see out in front of the gate to some piece of property, I see a big blue tractor. Passing this tractor and going, that's really cool. I'd like to have a tractor like that. Now, I have absolutely no need for a big blue tractor. I live on a quarter-acre lot in DeLand. But for a moment there, I thought, wow, that's a nice tractor. I like that tractor. And so I had this pleasant feeling arise that I want more of it. I'd like to have a tractor like that. Now, that feeling, I'd like to have a tractor, was conditioned by the perception of the tractor, which was conditioned by the fact that I have senses And then I happened to look in that direction. So came in, the blue tractor came in through the eye. The sense of sight interpreted that, perceived it as a tractor. The senses were there because I have name and form, because I exist in this kind of realm of physicality and mental presence. And the name and form had consciousness, so I was aware that I saw this tractor. And the consciousness was conditioned by some mental patterns. Some point in the past, I developed this idea that blue tractors were kind of cool, and that it would be fun to have one. And so this is how those links happened. Now, the next link would be craving. Now, I broke that link. I didn't connect those things because I looked at the blue tractor and goes, yeah, that would be kind of cool if I had a use for it, but I don't have a use for it, so that was that. Now, if one of my sankharas, one of those mental patterns from way back then, was conditioned by the idea that having a big blue tractor would lead to true happiness, then maybe it turns to craving. Oh man, I need that tractor. What am I going to do with it? Drive back and forth in my front yard? No. Maybe I need a farm. And so craving turns to becoming. Now I'm looking on my way home, I'm going to buy a tractor and the farm that goes with it. And so now I'm born a farmer. Now I know this is ridiculous, but think about how this works in day-to-day life and the kind of things that happen. And now I'm a farmer and I got to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and milk the daggum cow. So the idea that having a big blue tractor is going to lead to happiness is actually going to lead to stress. Now I've got the stress of having to take care of cattle or mow, plow fields and you know, and that sort of thing. Right? So at any point between the mental habit and the suffering, you can break the link. And that's why this is important. When you recognize the craving, or recognize the clinging, or even recognize that you're getting ready to go do something that you might regret later, you can stop. You can break the link. And every time you break the link, that sankhara, that mental habit that you had, has less hold on you. A real easy way to, you know, to see this as a reality. Any of you ever had a really bad habit, like smoke, or you know, drank too much, or chew your fingernails, or anything like that? So to break those habits, you find the link where you can break the link, and every time the feeling arises, every time the craving arises, every time the clinging arises, you break the link, and over time, it starts to extinguish. And so less and less often, those feelings will arise. And you'll recognize them with more reality when they do. So that's probably enough for one day. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Adventures of Sariputta and Moggallana. I hope the discussion of these key teachings of Buddhism is useful to you and your practice. There will be a few more of these in the coming weeks, and in the meantime, I hope that you'll put what you've learned to use. Now go save the world.